This workshop, this conversation can go. I have a lot to say in a lecture format, and we can also do a lot of questions and answers. I mean, there's just us here. There's nothing special happening, nothing formal happening, I mean. This is an extremely interesting topic. The way I'm going to describe, teach it to you today is the way that Yogananda expressed it, and especially through Kriyananda. Kriyananda is the American founder. His picture's always hidden, it's back there. But anyway, he's the American founder of Ananda. And he was a direct disciple of Yogananda. And what everything I know, I learned from Kriyananda. So the methods, the system that I'm going to talk to, the way I'm going to talk about the chakras is not anything I made up. It's the way Kriyananda taught it to me. It doesn't necessarily conform, you know, inch by inch for other things you may have heard. So just tell me what you thought was true or what you learned from someone else was true. Usually they reconcile. Sometimes we just have to agree to disagree. But I don't mind your saying, wait a minute, I think that's wrong, because there's a lot of information out and we need to be consistent. So I'm going to start with just some very basic ideas, and even if they're repetitious, at least we'll all be on the same page. I mean, from the point of view of what you already know. The basic premise of the chakras is based on the very simple fact that the material body that we live in is the manifestation of something more subtle. Of course, there's the very, very materialistic point of view about life is physical life is it. Who knows where it came from, and it certainly goes nowhere. You just live in this body for a while, then you die, you go into something or another, unconsciousness. The physical atoms disintegrate, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, that's the end of the story. After a while, and by after a while I mean over the course of usually of many lifetimes as our consciousness evolves, or maybe if you don't have to accept that, but let's assume it for a moment, gradually it begins to occur to us that there's something more subtle going on, and all of us sitting in here at least have come to some level or a very profound level of embracing the idea that there's a lot more to life than just the physical body. And that we may not exactly know where we came from or exactly where we're going, but something inside of us tells us that this is not the whole story. And so we begin that quest to figure out what the whole story actually is. And usually that quest eventually leads us to the writings or to the persons of individuals who speak with some authority about things that other people only speculate about. And if you become deeply immersed in it, if you become deeply persuaded, you find your way to God-realized masters, whether it's Jesus or Krishna or Yogananda or the ancient Vedic teachings of India. I'm doing thousands of years of evolution here in a very quick time just to put us on a shared understanding at least of where we're coming from. Okay, if this isn't crystal clear or absolutely true in your own mind is less important than we know where we're coming from. That we come to some authority who declare, and they declare from their own experience, not from speculation. It's not a philosophical speculation. In the West, we're really great at philosophical speculations. People like to say, maybe this is true, maybe that's true. I dropped out of college after 1 year. I lost interest after 1 week because I went to a philosophy class in which I wanted to know what was true. I was intensely interested in finding deep meaning in life, and I found a lot of people who wanted to just speculate, and they didn't even really seem to care. This is what this one thought, this is what that one thought. I wasn't interested in speculation. It was a matter of deep personal need for me. It wasn't just an entertainment. So in the West, we endlessly speculate, and in fact, we're suspicious if people are too certain. We accept that science can be certain, because we think they've experimented and they've proved it, and of course they change their minds every few years too. But we get upset if somebody's talking about abstract things, nonsense-oriented things, and declare it. Because in the West we don't understand that you can experiment with consciousness and have reproducible results just as you can in any other medium. And so the science of yoga is the science of experimenting with consciousness and getting reproducible results. I mean, Sonia's a hatha yoga teacher. You practice yoga. You know, Elena says she's done a little bit of yoga too. I mean, I have practiced, not much at the moment, but the postures are done a certain way. And the reason they're done a certain way is because people have experimented, and that's what brings the right result. And they're experimenting in the West. Many people think of it as only physical, but the fact is those postures are deeply related to consciousness, and it's precise because consciousness is precise. So we have authorities in many fields that we respect, and of course in the spiritual field there are also authorities, and they speak authoritatively from experience, verified over generations, thousands and millennia, if we go out of this culture and go into India, you know, where this has been practiced continuously for years beyond count, thousands at least, and master after master after master verifies the same experiment brings the same results. In fact, one of the ways you can tell a true teacher from a false teacher is that they do not repudiate what a true master before them has come, has said. Even when the Jewish rabbis challenged Jesus, he said, I come to fulfill your prophets, not to deny them. And it was very important in the verification of at that time, you know, Jesus was constantly showing that he was simply fulfilling what their own prophets had said, and he was being consistent with everything that had been taught before, because this is an absolute truth. You know, if somebody comes along and says, you know, you really should walk on your elbows and you should breathe through your knees, everybody would just laugh, because we don't walk on our elbows and we don't breathe through our knees, and we all know it. So among spiritual teachings, when if one master suddenly says something that no master has ever said before and that doesn't even relate to it, well, that's how you can tell a false teacher from a true one. If a teacher comes and innovates a little bit in a line that's consistent, Jesus came and said, God is not a harsh judge, he's your loving father. That was just a progression. That wasn't a, he was correcting a misunderstanding. Buddha said, you know, don't just rely on the gods, your own actions make a difference. He was reforming. He wasn't repudiating, he was reforming. Yogananda says, meditation, look within. You know, God is a loving mother. He took it even a step farther than Jesus had taken it. But he's not repudiating, he's just adding to the great body of this. So the masters have declared this science of yoga, the science of yoga, and the anatomy of yoga. And the anatomy of yoga is describing to us the subtle origin of what we can all verify with our senses. We all live in these bodies and we feel them and we experience them, and they are largely inexplicable to us. I don't just mean medically. How did we get here? Why do I age? Why did Alfonso's hair fall out? Why is your hair turning a little bit gray? You know, why don't I have the same youthful face that I used to have? Why does weight stay on my body when it never used to? I mean, it's all just a great mystery to us. And that doesn't even take into account, why am I sick? Why am I well? Why am I happy? Why am I sad? Why do I loathe the rain and love the sunshine? Why was I so happy when I went to Greece? Why do I hate Texas? You know, just all these different things. Why did I fall immediately in love with you and totally dislike you? All these inexplicable things that happen are not inexplicable to the masters, because they explain to us the subtle force that makes us who we are now. And a key element in that is our subject for the day, which is the chakras. The chakras are the transition reality between the past and the present and the future, between the physical and the non-physical. And you know, they're just the fulcrum of a great deal that happens. That's why it's such a marvelous subject. And the basic premise, to be specific now, about our physical bodies, the chakras, is the masters all speak of the fact that we essentially have three bodies. The physical body is the one that we know the best. There's an energy body, and then there's a physical and astral and a causal, is how it's described. And we tend to think, because we live in the physical and the physical seems like the largest and the most concrete, that it all emanates from the physical. In fact, there are medical doctors and scientists who basically think that the brain creates consciousness. And so they imagine that if you could get a computer that was smart enough, you could make that computer self-aware, because they think if the brain is sophisticated enough, then self-awareness magically springs out of that. In fact, it's consciousness that exists first, and then consciousness manifests the brain. And as soon as you withdraw the consciousness, the brain just becomes an inert object. If you've ever been with anyone who's passed away, or been, especially if you've been with someone who dies, and it's like they're present and then they're absent. And the body is their reality, and then the body becomes like less than irrelevant. It becomes a piece of furniture. Even, you know, your sort of the magnetic attraction to the body, if you're in a room with someone that you care about, you tend to relate to them. And what you're actually relating to is the physical form that they're encased in. If I were to take off my outer sweater here and dump it over in the corner, you all would not start relating to my sweater over there, because the animating force that makes the sweater related to me would be over here at this point, because I would have taken the sweater off. If you're ever in a room with someone who dies, my friend told me her father was dying, and like often happens, sometimes people, you'll sit by their bed forever and then you go outside for 1 minute and that's the minute they choose to die, because often people find it difficult to leave their bodies when their loved ones are in the room. So they'll often wait for just that little tiny interlude when you've walked out, and then they can leave. So she'd been sitting with her father for days. She went home finally to get a little bit of rest. As soon as she reached her house, they called and said he died. So she came back to the hospital. She said, and they had left his body in the room until she got there. She said immediately when she walked into the room, she was aware of two things simultaneously. First, that her father was present in the room. And secondly, that he was not and never had been that body. But that, as she put it, because she had only related to him through that body, she had made the natural mistake of thinking that body was him. And so she walked in there and she could feel him, but the body was no longer the focal point of him. So she looked at the body and it was completely irrelevant, but she could feel that he was in the room, essentially waiting for her. And she just had a moment of nonverbal communication with him, in which she said goodbye, and because she's spiritually inclined, she encouraged him to go. And then she felt him leave, and then there was no one in the room. Right? Now, because the brain was still there, but the brain itself can't create the consciousness, so the brain meant nothing once the consciousness was gone. Yogananda says something that I have always loved. People who think that consciousness, this is his words, people who think that consciousness is created by the brain, when they begin to die and they feel the brain die, they feel obligated to go unconscious, is how he put it. People who have done a little bit of meditation or have any understanding that consciousness exists outside of the physical, when the physical begins to die, they can, not easily, but it is possible to at least retain some awareness or to regain it quickly, because you understand that even though the body dies, the consciousness can go on. But people who are very, very physical in their understanding of reality, when the body dies, they become essentially unconscious. And Yogananda said, even in the astral world, they just kind of are in a dream state, and they don't really wake up until they have another body. And then when they come into a child's body, then they know what to do again, and they start waking up again. But in the non-physical world, they can hardly see the non-physical world, because they just don't have any category in the brain for it. Isn't that fascinating? In their awareness. This is the enormous importance of developing non-physical sense of the non-physical while you're still in the physical body, because we spend a lot of time not in physical bodies, and we're in lots of realms, and we don't want to just be in dull grayness. We want to be able to continue to expand our awareness even outside of the physical body. Now, the basic building, let me say something else. Everything in the physical world is organized and constructed to teach us about more subtle levels of reality. Subtle and gross is a good way to think of this. Gross not in the sense of repulsive, the way teenagers use the word, ooh, that's gross, but just gross in the sense of not subtle. Because what we see here is not subtle, it's very solid. Whereas the vibrations that animate this are more subtle and a little bit harder to see with the gross physical sight. So the physical body is gross, and there's more and more subtle energies behind it. And it's the subtle energies that are the ever-existing energies, and it's the physical world that manifests and disintegrates. Everything in the physical world is dual. Everything in the universe is dual, actually. So you have life, you have to have death. You have youth, you have to have old age. You have to have hair, then you have baldness. You have slimness, then you have pudginess. These, everything is dual, morning and night. So everything in this world lasts for a while, and then it goes away. And that's the most remarkable thing about human beings, is we're all born and we all die, and we all think we're going to last forever. We think real estate prices will just go up. I mean, like, nothing just goes up. Everything also goes down. It's just the way this world is. Nothing. You cannot push this world to one side and have it stay there ever. But we're so short-sighted. That's what we imagine will happen. So we invest in youth, and we're startled when we have old age. We abuse the health of our bodies, and we're startled when we get ill. You know, just all these things. It's always, that's the way this world is. It's always a duality. Now, in more subtle worlds, it's also dual, but the vibration is not so extreme. It's just, it's more subtle. This is a gross world, so it's, you know, it's very obvious here. Now, the way the masters describe the manifestation, and this is the picture I want to, the first picture I want to draw, as I was saying, because we see the physical the most, and because it looks large to us, we tend to think of ourselves as, we tend to think of ourselves as sort of this enormous apex right here. We tend to think of the other, the spirit world, as we narrow down and go into it. We close our senses, we think like this. This is the big physical world, and then we contract like this. In fact, it's exactly the opposite, which is what you have, is you have infinite. Let's imagine these lines go off the page here. It's like a funnel, and it comes down like this. And this is actually where we live, in relationship both to the universe and to our own potential, which is identified with one physical body, with one ego, with one incarnation. We are about as contracted as we ever are going to be. And the process of self-realization is an ever-increasing realization of who and what we actually are. And we, you know, we call our teaching self-realization, when people ask, what are we? We are self-realizationists. It's not exactly a religion, it's what we practice, because we are realizing who we actually are. That's all, simple as that. It's a generic word, and everybody can use it. It doesn't really belong to us. So we think, I think, that I'm Asha, that I was born American, that my husband is David, that I'm 62 years old, 61 almost, almost 62 years old, that I travel, I've traveled a lot, you know, that my hair is curly, that I have good genes and I don't have to diet, it's always still this color. You know, these are the things that I think of that are me, right? I'm a little witty, I'm a little humorous, I wasn't beautiful as a teenager, so I had to become clever. You know, these are all the things that I know about me, right? But in fact, when this body dies, and the self that animates this body that has put on this garb is freed from that little identification, I will discover, and every time I meditate, and many other times during my life, it's gradually occurred to me that this little thing that I call myself is actually a manifestation of some other power. I've moved into it, I've meditated, I've felt it, I've sensed it intuitively from when I was a little child. I used to look out the window and think, there's got to be something else. I could just tell there was something else, I just didn't know what it was. You know, this can't be all. And all of you, you feel it, you know it's true. And what you do is you begin to expand your awareness. Even in the world that we live in now, there are people, if I said to them, you're more than your physical body, they would just laugh me out of town. They would think it was the stupidest thing they ever heard, right? But we have already moved from the tiniest circle, you know, to here, or wherever we want to be on the spectrum, that we identify with our, we're, we identify more globally, we identify with the health of the planet. You know, you have somebody here who identifies with not only their country, I mean, look what happened in Sarajevo, in Kosovo, where those people were just able to say, you're another ethnic group than us, you're not even a human being, we'll slash you to pieces. You know, their identity was so small that somebody who was right here, they defined as not them. You know, their sense of realization was really, really tiny, so small that they felt they could just murder those people. But all it is just a narrowing identification. The saints, see, what happens is, once we start opening up, we expand and we expand. First, we become global in our identities. We accept other cultures. But then when does it stop? We accept sentient creatures, we accept the earth, the flowers, but the fact of the matter is, once we begin to raise our consciousness and expand our awareness, what's the limit of that expansion? You see?
Infinite.
It's infinite, of course. This is what the masters tell us, but this is also something we can experience. We can experience, as we have expanded our awareness in whatever way we have, in this one life that we can remember, and come to understand and accept things that we couldn't have imagined at an earlier stage of our life, you know, at what point does that stop? The masters tell us it's infinite, but we can actually see ourselves. What is the boundary of it? When I found myself, I'm a young Jewish girl living in a yogi commune and even for a number of years living as a monastic, it was like, how did I get here? You know, this is not something I never thought about God when I was younger. I thought about something, but I never called it God. And if you had told me when I was 12 that I would devote my life to God, I wouldn't have said no, but it certainly would have been an odd thought to me. But now my awareness has expanded to a concept of God that I couldn't have imagined when I was younger. So where will it stop? You see? And the masters tell us it never stops. It's infinite. Okay, and then they describe to us that there's three levels, three worlds in which we live, and in all of them we have something that looks like a physical body. The form and reality of this physical body is the grosser manifestation of a more subtle blueprint. And the way the masters describe it is first you have the idea, then you have the energy, and then you have the form. Okay? The idea, it's obvious. So think of it like this. And this is what I was going to say. This equals the causal. This equals the astral. And this equals the physical. And if you think of it even just like, let's say, well, the building right next to this one we built. I mean, we built it, this group built it within recent memory. It was an old house. We had the idea that we would tear down that old house and we would put a nicer building there. So first we had to have the idea that even such a thing was possible and we were going to do it. Then we went to architects and we got a blueprint. And I'll put the word blueprint up here because blueprint helps. And we got a blueprint for how we were going to build that building. It took a certain amount of energy to take that idea and bring it to a clear focus, right? But it was still just a blueprint. We didn't yet have the form. But we had the energy form in place. We had the pictures, we had the engineering drawings, we knew what was needed, and then we applied more energy and brought it into form. And now there's a building over there. And you walk through that building reflects the idea we had about it, the blueprint that we drew, the energy pattern that we created. We created an energy pattern, that's the word I'm looking for, in the form of a blueprint since we were making a building. And then we took that energy pattern and we manifested it into form. All life is a constantly being creative process, and it takes all three of these realities. If you think of anything you do in your life, first you have the idea to do it, then you create the energy pattern for it, which is to say you have a thought about what you're going to do. I'm going to go to Sweden and I'm going to study their architecture. So you have an energy pattern in your mind. Then you call the travel agent. You know, you'd get it all together, and then you go to Sweden and you study architecture.
So the energy is more the action rather than anything tangible?
It's in between. Astral is not physical, but it's tangible. Energy is tangible. If it's not tangible, how do I say that? The astral form is more subtle than this form. I need to say physical form, material form, because energy has form. You can see it. It's light, it's sound. And so energy has form, but it's energy form, and this is material form. Is that fair enough? A blueprint is also material, but in the astral world where there's nothing that's material, but energy coalesces into form that you can see. You have your astral body. Is not, think of the movies. Think how the movies are now. Somebody dies, the actor falls to the ground, and then immediately the actor gets up again. He's slightly translucent, he can walk through walls, and the physical people this is all movies. The physical people in the movies can't see him because he's too subtle for them to perceive with their senses. But he's still there because the energy form has coalesced. The energy has coalesced into this form, but it hasn't coalesced all the way down. To think of it like maybe water into ice. You know, the water, yeah, the transformation. It's the same thing getting more solid. Okay, that's a very good one. You have mist that settles on the river and then the river freezes. Sort of like that, where it's the same thing. Nothing has actually changed, but it's solidified. Or lava. The lava flows and then it cools and it's still a little molten and then it changes to solid rock. And it's the same thing from start to finish, but it keeps transforming because it becomes more and more fixed. The difference between an idea and a material form is rigidity. Like an idea is still quite mutable. It can go here and there. By the time you've taken that idea and made that building, you know, for us now to change the material form of that building is going to be a tremendous amount of work going backwards. But when we were still just talking about that building, it was extremely mutable. It could just be shifted. We could just shift it at any moment. Even when it was in the astral form, the blueprint form, it was still quite shiftable. But once it reached the form of the building, to shift it now is going to be a big job. Now that's important to understand when we start applying this, which we will very soon, which we are already, to the chakras. Because even though the form is mutable, meaning it can be changed, nonetheless, it takes energy to change it. Even when we got this thing to the point, using the building, to the point of the blueprint, we'd had to get professionals involved, we'd had to have lots of meetings, we'd had to spend lots of money. So in theory, you could just erase the blueprint and make a new one. But in fact, it was going to take a commensurate amount of energy even to shift the blueprint as it had taken to create the blueprint. And in a very real sense, the energy in our chakras, which I'm skipping ahead, but I'll come back to, is a blueprint for the manifestation of our lives. And even though if we don't like the manifestation, we might want to change the blueprint, it took a lot of energy to get that blueprint in place, and it took a lot of energy to manifest that blueprint. So we can't say, well, for example, oh, here's our school building. We did not put an indoor bathroom into the tiny children's classroom. We can't send four-year-olds down the hall to go to the bathroom. That was really dumb. But by that point, there was so much energy committed to not having an internal bathroom that it was, well, we'll just put the little kids in a different room because we can't create the new bathroom, even though we had a great idea to do so. So if, for example, your karma, which I'll explain these more clearly, has gotten you into some terrible mess, and you can say, oh, this was really a stupid idea. How did I ever get here? You may say, oh, it's all energy. I can shift it. Well, it is all energy, but you're going to have to put out as much energy to shift that blueprint and that idea and then re-manifest it as you spent manifesting it. Over on this lot, before we took it down, there was a house that was built in 1906. It was about to be declared an historic treasure. It was actually an historic eyesore. So we had to get rid of it before the city of Palo Alto would not have let us. So we got this big machine that this man came and he ate the building with this machine like this. It was fantastic. We had all the kids out, everybody was watching. You know, but somebody had put out a lot of energy to get that thing there. And time had been disintegrating. We had to get a great machine to eat it back up again and all this garbage and throw it away. You know, to break that form, we had to put out really energy on the level in which that form had been created. You see? So merely to know that everything is made in this way, that's why people fail when they just try to affirm a new reality. Because the energy that created that reality may be this big, and the affirmation they're doing is about this big, and they keep doing it, but it's not the same size as what created it.
You mean you live your whole life a certain way,
Because of the momentum that you've put underway. And I'll be more specific as we go along. But if you're on the freeway and you're going 100 miles an hour and you're heading north and you realize you've missed your exit, you know? Yes. Yeah, you can't just whammo get over into that exit. You have to. It took me 45 minutes once to turn around on the freeway over here because there was not only did I have to make the turn, but then I took the wrong turn, and then there was construction, and then there was commute traffic because I was going the different way. It took me 45 minutes to miss my exit and turn around and get back because it's not so easy because there was momentum. I had momentum. I sailed past it. I had to slow the momentum. I had to redirect it. I stumbled onto obstacles in the process. Eventually, I got back. But so it is. Our life has a certain momentum. And then when we want to shift it, we can, but you can't do it like that unless you have the power to generate in an instant all the energy that you've already generated, something that matches, right? If you could teleport yourself, if I had the power to transmute the atoms of my automobile in an instant and it'll get over, but I don't have that kind of energy. I had to do it the ordinary way. So Libby, what's your question?
I'm just kind of...
It'll get more clear.
Yeah, it's kind of like you have the idea you missed
the turn. Right.
Now you have to have the energy or a plan to fix it.
Right.
And that is applicable to your life in the fact that if you want to change something about who you are, how you think,
right,
what you see, you can't just do it. You have to have a plan and pursue it.
And you have to, the main key here is you have to put out as much energy to create the new pattern as has already been invested to create the old pattern. The old pattern weighs 150 pounds or 900 pounds or 3 tons. And you can't just say over here, oh, old pattern, move, you know, and poke it with your finger. You have to figure out how, just like we had to get a machine. We couldn't just get rid of that old building. We had to get that giant machine to eat the building and then haul everything away. Because that's how heavy it was. And so if I have an idea that, gee, I ought to be a sweeter, nicer person, I can be a sweeter, nicer person, but if I've spent a lot of time being kind of a cynical, mean person, and that habit is really deep in me, and I'll show you, we're going to go to the chakras in about a minute here, then you have to put out as much energy in the new direction as is already in the old direction for it to shift. However, it is all just energy. Energy has no, it's not a form, it's just energy. But energy has power, you know. And so you have to put out as much force in the other way. Yes, Alfonso.
So it's something that is probably very difficult to understand sometimes. It's like we're coming from the idea would be like the pure thought, you know,
right,
the thought of the bliss, in total purity, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's like super conscious,
right,
consciousness. So we go through that, you know,
right,
at least in order to manifest, and this is who we are, you know, like the material form.
Right.
And it looks like we come to a very solid way of being,
right,
the duality of existence.
Right.
But we have to complete the cycle. It looks like a circle.
Uh-huh.
Like you have to go back to the cycle and it complete the cycle, and the cycle is to undo all this solidness that we have in order to little by little go, as you said, you know, like went from the ice
to water.
To water, and from water to the
right,
mist.
Right.
Into like the...
Into the infinite.
Infinite.
Right.
Isn't it? And what I don't understand, I mean, we do that cycle.
Right.
You come from idea into this, and then you have to work your...
Way out of it again?
Yes. Yeah, is what is changing your ways.
You're okay, let me sort of interrupt that.
You're supposed to be kind, loving.
Right.
You know, like the
Let me pause your question, because now I'm going to put the chart of the chakras up,
okay,
and we'll start answering it.
Okay.
If in an hour and a half you still don't understand, then we'll come back to your question. Because to answer it, I have to tell you everything else. Go ahead.
Or a thought.
Sure.
So I feel like, wouldn't you say there's even a fourth level? Like, idea is the point where energy comes into like a thought, like I have an idea, and it's not anything yet, it's just an idea. But before ideas, isn't there,
it's
just
pure
consciousness, thought, like wordless thought,
pure this consciousness, if you
energy.
I mean, before the idea is pure consciousness, and actually what it actually is Satchitananda, This is Satchitananda is the fabulous word that in English is called God, which is ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy. And that's a word for God. That's a lovely word for the infinite, because if you just say infinite, it has no feeling quality to it. But ever-existing, Sat, ever-conscious, which is Chid, Ananda, which is bliss. Ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy is how Yogananda called it. So it's consciousness itself which inspires the idea, and Satchitananda is that consciousness. So yes, exactly right. And so in terms of self-realization, we go from we expand our awareness. Now, it's not that you absent yourself from the physical body, because Yogananda walked around in a physical body. Jesus walked around in a physical body, but he was conscious of everything at the same time.
He's metaphorically speaking.
Yes, exactly. But it's important to realize that you start where you are and you just keep expanding. You add to it. You don't ever lose it. Somebody once said, how could you betray your Judaism? I said, you're the one who's telling me that I've left it. I never left it. I just added it to the picture and got bigger. So you don't leave this. You just keep getting bigger and bigger at the same time. See, many people stop here, or they're a little bit aware of this. I mean, it's not that they don't have ideas, but even everything that they do is circumscribed by a material concept of life.
Well, isn't it that when, you know, we leave this form is when we kind of like go back to like the astral world and we check in and say, yeah, I do right this time or not, I have to.
Well, if you're conscious, you
work on something else.
Everybody dies, and everybody has an astral and a causal body, but if you don't have sufficiently subtle awareness, even when you're out of your physical body, you're just not conscious. If you're a good meditator and you have an awareness, if you have a subtle nature, you don't have to know that you have a subtle nature, like artists, scientists, you know, people who have a subtle nature, who are aware of just subtle realms. They're very conscious in the astral world, but they may only be conscious of science. They won't necessarily be conscious of God. Does that make sense?
Yes. Idea, energy, and material form. Does it relate to superconsciousness, subconsciousness, consciousness? Is there a direct parallel line?
No. Okay, no. So I'll just leave it for the moment. Okay, I'll tell you about it later, but I don't want to go there at the moment. People try to do that, but it doesn't. So just drop it, and I'm going to have to answer you in a minute, but let me answer you later. Okay. So now what we're working with is, since we talk about the concept of idea and blueprint and then form, since we're dealing with a blueprint concept, the physical body that we live in is based on the blueprint of the astral body. And in fact, the form of the body itself, see this picture here, this is the spiritual eye. The spiritual eye is something that everyone who meditates deeply sees. You see it first just as bright light. But if you can meditate very subtly, it gradually forms itself. And you don't see the figure with his arms up. What you see, the circle of golden light, a dark field in the middle, and then a bright light in the center. Even if you rub your eyes, the after image looks like that. It's a circle, a dark, and then there's light in the middle. Now, if you're very, very concentrated, that light in the middle forms itself into a star.
Really?
Really. Okay, the star is in the middle, and the star is the whole story of Jesus about the star of Bethlehem and the wise men who saw the star. It's an allegory that those who have ears to hear can understand. The wise men meditated. They saw the spiritual eye. They were guided by that intuitive wisdom. The star represents the Christ consciousness, the highest realm of understanding. It was his star. Okay. Now the star is 5 points, like this. It's a 5-pointed star. It's not a Star of David, 6-pointed star. The head and like this. The Catholics, interestingly, have this symbol of a dove. And the dove has its two wings out, it has 2 points for its tail, and it has a head. It's a 5-pointed image. When I went to Rome for the first time, and I went to the Vatican, and right in the middle of the big St. Peter's Cathedral, there's this humongous thing that has a name where the priests come to do Mass. Huge, ornate, unbelievably large and lovely thing. You go stand in the center of it, and you look up. There's a bright golden ring, there's a dark blue, and then there's a white dove, a 5-pointed dove right in the center. Whoever designed it saw that. And he wanted to create what he knew it to be was the expanded realms, and he put it right up there. It's amazing. It's absolutely gorgeous. I was so amazed when I saw it. Okay. So they say, the masters tell us, the reason the body looks like it looks is it's actually based on that star image. It's very interesting. So even when we die physically, our body still looks essentially like this, except it's ephemeral. It's made of light rather than made of, it's made of light and energy, but it's not so solid. It's easier to shift, and it's lighter, and it's not, we're burdened by these bodies. And they oppress our feelings and our sensitivity. When we shed the body and are just the energy behind the body, we're much lighter. And when we can move just into the idea of the body, which is the causal world, we're even lighter still. Now, most of this conversation is really about the physical and the astral, because that's really where we're stuck. If your problem was between the astral and the causal, you wouldn't be here. You probably wouldn't be on this planet, and you certainly wouldn't be in this class. So we're just going to talk about the physical and the astral. Now, the way the physical body looks, if you were trying to figure out what the blueprint looked like, the body, the physiological reality of the body emanates from the spine. This is the science of osteopathic adjustment, of chiropractic adjustment. There's this huge channel that's full of nerves that runs right through the center of the body. It's not the knobs of the spine. It runs through the center as if there was a plumb line from here, you know, down through the pelvis. And that's where, gathered here, there are these nerve centers. You know, there's one at the throat, there's one here at the spiritual eye, at the throat, at the heart, you know, at this part of the body, here for the sexual organs, and then for the organs of elimination. If you take the body apart, you see that nerves emanate out, that the body is run from the center. This is the idea of the body, it's run from the center, and it's run through the spine. In fact, when a child is conceived, Yogananda says the first, this is his statement, the first cell is right here at the medulla. This is the only part of the body that can't be operated on. If you interfere with this, the body can't survive. Because this is, Yogananda says, is actually the origin point of our inhabiting this body. And the sperm and the ovum, Yogananda said, unite at this point. And then if you look at the little pictures in the diagram books of the developing embryo, the first thing that happens is a little potato stick. The first thing that happens is that it makes the spine. And then it gradually makes the nerve centers, and then the body is formed out from that point. So if we're going to reverse the process of understanding who we are in our origin point, we essentially reverse it. We withdraw from the periphery, we go back to the center, the spine, and we go back to the origin points in the physical body, the nerve centers, in the astral body, the chakras. The reason that the nerves are concentrated here is because the spiritual anatomy is centered in the spine, and it has the energy centers here, and from those energy centers, everything emanates. Does that make sense? Is that a clear picture? Okay, so now what the chakras represent, I'm just going to draw a straight line, and this straight line is from, well, if you were doing your body, it's essentially the torso and the head. You know, if you think about how physical life can exist, and you may have seen pictures of people who are considered to be freaks, you can get all the way down to the torso and the head, and you're still there. You know, all of this can be cut off. If you think about it, you know, you could be like a little worm. And occasionally people are born that way, or by accidents they turn into worms, but they're still there. You know, because none of this is actually you. But you can't go much lower than that, because this is really the origin of who you are. And the chakras essentially go from the crown of the head to the base of the pelvis. This is the section where the now, bear in mind, the chakras are not physical. They're not bound by the physical body. No surgeon's knife can cut them out. I mean, one woman wrote me very distressed because she'd had a hysterectomy and someone had told her second chakra had been removed. Hysterectomy is when you take out the female organs. So she had all of this was cut into, and a lot of it was taken out. She thought she'd lost her chakra. There's no way. The chakra is energy. A surgeon's knife is physical. Yeah, it was very scary to her, but of course it isn't true, because energy is not affected. Just like when in the movies, which I like the movies now for this, the body dies, they get up, they're still there. So, physically speaking, now, let me just explain to you now what the purpose of the chakras is on a bigger scale, and we'll go back to the mechanics of it. The understanding of chakras is based on an understanding of what life is for and what forward progress is in life. I've made reference to self-realization. I've talked about expanding awareness. Okay, there's a, life is not random. There's a direction and a purpose to it. And the purpose of life is simply this. We are very limited in our awareness of who we are, what we are, and what reality is about. We are very limited in our awareness as collectively human beings as to what causes us suffering and what brings us happiness. Progress is to understand what causes suffering, what brings us happiness, in other words, and that means to understand who we are, what's lastingly real. And the purpose of life, the purpose of physical life, is to learn those lessons, the divinely mandated, the scientifically true purpose of life is to find out where happiness comes from. In other words, to realize who we really are. Sat Chit Ananda is the goal. We are ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. But, you know, most of the time we walk down the street and we don't know ourselves to be ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. We're bored, we're hungry, we're sleepy, we're angry, we're afraid. You know, we're constantly living at a vibration that is different than the pure vibration of who we really are. And what we do over the course of life, we're motivated by two things. All living creatures are motivated by two things: the desire to escape suffering, the desire to experience ever greater and deeper levels of happiness. Isn't that true? I mean, if you think about it, absolutely everything that you have done and everything that anybody around you is doing is always motivated by that. Sometimes intensely misguided, sometimes transparently stupid, but only in retrospect. In the moment, it seemed like a good idea. We thought it would increase our happiness and diminish our suffering. That's why we did it. And we only stop doing X, Y, or Z when we realize that it increases our suffering and diminishes our happiness. And we will never change, and no one will ever change until that relationship is clear to them. That's why no matter how often you tell your alcoholic brother to stop drinking, that he's ruining his life, he won't stop drinking until it causes him more pain to drink. It may cause you more pain for him to drink, but it's not for him. The state of intoxication he still feels reduces his suffering. And you know, that's why you can't really tell anybody anything until their own experiences brought them to that point. Now, this simply tells you the need for more than one incarnation, doesn't it? Because we can learn a certain amount in one incarnation, but if we were condemned to only learn what we can learn in one life, we're never going to make it all the way to Sat Chit Ananda. It's just, yes, in theory you can, but as I'll explain in a few moments, it takes more energy than we can usually generate. By the time you're there, you've had a lot of incarnations behind it. So reincarnation becomes a simply either this is a horrible joke and there is no God, or we need a little more time to figure this out, right? So once you bring in the idea of reincarnation, the whole system begins to work, and it's essential that you have reincarnation. Because without reincarnation, how can you be going to perfection when so obviously nobody makes it? You can progress. It's quite clear that you can progress or regress, because you watch people regress also. But to make it all the way, you have to see this as simply one inning in a big game, one chapter in a long book. Then I make a certain amount of progress, and then I get to start where I stopped, and then I can make a certain amount. Chakras are the key to that progress. Okay, at any point in life, we are responding in our thoughts, in our actions, in our relationships with other people. We are responding according to what we believe is true in terms of what will bring us happiness and what will cause us to escape suffering. What will bring us ultimate happiness, everlasting happiness, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy, is to be always in perfect knowledge and harmony with the Infinite Spirit, and to just look at this world in a very interesting way and see all the little incarnated forms, including mine, just running around doing its little business, but never to lose consciousness of that Infinite Spirit. Jesus was a Christ. He had Christ consciousness, which is the same as Sat Chit Ananda. He's crucified on the cross. He looks down at these people who have crucified him, and his one thought is, "Oh, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." right? They've done this awful thing. They've crucified me. They're going to have some really bad karma to pay. And he's trying to intercede, you know, to help them. He doesn't notice that he's the one hanging on the cross. Now, the average person's thought, just like the two thieves that were on either side of Jesus, one of them is railing against his fate one way or another. But the other thief says, look, we deserve to be hung here. This man doesn't deserve it. And he's still mad at everybody for what's been done to him. But Jesus' view is completely different. This is a divine play. It doesn't make any difference. Now, in our own little lives, Christ-like forgiveness is that somebody does something unkind to you, and our immediate thought is, oh, I wonder, he must be suffering, poor man. You know, you reach out in kindness to somebody who's unkind to you because your awareness is such that your compassion is for him, not concern for yourself. Or something unexpected happens, and maybe you don't have the same money that you thought you were going to have, or somebody in a relationship hasn't treated you nicely. Do I believe that my happiness depends on having that money and having this person and having it be just the way I want it? In other words, am I this one person alone in this world and I have to get everything all set up to have it just my way? Or can I say, well, everything happens according to the divine plan? And when you're going down the freeway and you think you're going to be in an accident, is the first thought of fear? Or is there this complete, calm understanding that everything happens the way it's supposed to happen? You see, at any moment, we're always responding either with calculated consciousness or instinctively in a moment of stress, we affirm a certain level of reality. Somewhere between Satchitananda and I am the physical body, no one else is real, whatever I can get for myself is what makes me happy. And this is the murderer or the thief or Bernard Madoff, whatever the man's name is, you know? But I mean, somewhere in that, he began to become so contracted in his thinking that he actually thought he could do those things. You know, he lost connection. I'm sure he's not as bad a man as he became, but somewhere in there, his thought of what would make him happy began to exclude everyone else, and he got more and more contracted. Oh, it's the man who just did this horrible financial scandal. The man who took all the money. Yeah, he took all that money, you know. And so, but he became very contracted, and he became very confused about what was true. But, you know, he's an example. You can see how even a person who should know better, you could see how the fear set in and fear contracted him and he became, all these things happened. So as a consequence, he affirmed a very dark reality, which is if I can just get mine, I don't care what happens to anyone else. So all day long, every minute of every day, with every thought, every breath, every action, we are affirming, make it horizontally, something between Satchitananda and the worst that you can imagine of somebody who has no regard for any reality but his own. Even lower than a murderer, somebody who just sleeps all the time, who just doesn't even do anything, who's just nobody.
It would be the lowest,
say again?
It would be the lowest state of delusion, of the material delusion, or like the most ego side of it, the most pure to
the most, yes, you could say that. Pure beyond ego, totally. I mean, to be, even Madoff had a lot of energy, so he's more advanced than the man who doesn't do anything at all, who has no energy. Madoff's energy was misdirected, but at least he had some. Even beneath him is somebody who just does nothing, right? Who doesn't even, just does nothing going through him, yes.
So my question is, all this stuff, I've taken lots of workshops and readings and I believe it and I feel it when I meditate. And it's mm-hmm. wonderful as a concept and I feel it in my heart to be true. My question is, like, what steps and what, like, actual
head of
practices
me.
Is there to maintain that practice, develop it, and feel it every day? Because I know people come in many ranges of mm-hmm. person, and one minute I can feel this and I believe it and I'm so open and warm and I love everyone. I have a lot of energy and I have a very reactive, emotional,
right.
and ego body. And I catch myself just so caught up in like defensiveness or fear or anxiety that like really that becomes so powerful that little voice in me that's like,
right.
let it go. You are not this experience. You are not these feelings or these thoughts is like very, very difficult to listen to, and I just feel myself like act in the wrong way. And that causes me more pain and suffering, of course.
There's two points that I'll work with. One is, before we're finished, I'll give you specific practices. But the second thing is, if you have a very clear idea of how the chakras work with each other and why that keeps happening to you, that will help you to do more than just say, don't be like this.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you really understand the mechanism, then one, it gives you a more compassionate attitude towards yourself, which is a good step forward. And a more compassionate attitude towards yourself will help mitigate the effect. It will also help you it'll give you a much clearer sense of visualization about what's actually happening, and that will lead to a greater understanding of what to do. Does that make sense? Right now, you're just caught.
So,
things are just reacting, you know, here's a good idea, here's a bad idea, smash like that, you know. What we need to do is we need to have some conscious awareness of why they come together, how they smash, and then you can interrupt it more easily. That's where we're going. We're not there yet.
Yes, exactly that same question, and you answered to me in the most unbelievable way. You said that you live in a world of duality, and it's like a pendulum, and it was amazing. You go from bad to good, but you're supposed to get to the center, to be neutralized, and there are those techniques that she teaches about, she says about, in which allows you to always act in harmony, like in peace, you know, either instead of no anger when you feel, or like all crazy happiness on the other way, they settle in the middle, and there are techniques to achieve this.
And what Alfonso's answering you, I gave him that answer, I wouldn't exactly give you the same one, but part of it is that you need to be more centered all the time. So that even your positive comes out of the center, because what's happening now, probably, I don't know you well enough, so this would be unfair, but what can happen is that what happens is even when we're positive, we get off center. And when we're off center, we're not standing on our strength. If I'm standing like this and you bump into me, I probably won't fall. If I'm standing like this and you bump into me, I'll probably get knocked over.
Okay.
So sometimes when we start getting happy, we start going like this. And then when something small comes, we're off balance. Whereas if
That's
even,
for sure.
Okay, so even if our happiness is rooted in the trunk of the tree, then when the wind blows, we just go like this. We don't fall over. So that's part of it. And before I'm finished, I just realized I've been so confused. This clock hasn't been changed back here. I'm thinking, amazing, only 20 minutes into this class and we've said so much already. Just subconsciously it was influencing me.
So,
did you have a question?
Yeah, so the awareness of the chakras actually enables your free will to be exercised more carefully?
Yes, precisely, because you stay more in the center, and so you're more in command of what you're doing.
You don't get caught up
as much.
Emotional
reactions. I'm going to go, all of this, believe me, is necessary, because otherwise the chakras don't make any sense. So now we have the concept of the spectrum, right? Between Satchitananda and the most ego. Do we need a break? Do we need to break now, or should I give
it?
About 20 after 11. Let me get you a little farther, just a little farther, then I'll give you a break. We have this spectrum. Okay, what the chakras represent, and now I'm going to make this vertical, and this is just going to be the first, second, third, fourth chakra is the heart, so you'll know where we are. And this is the navel. Okay, the heart, and then this is the throat. I'm just going to use simple English. This is the spiritual eye. And then there's the seventh chakra, which is the thousand-petal lotus at the top of the head. Here's the head. Here's the human eyes. Here's the mouth. Here's the nose, so you'll know where we are. Doesn't look like much, does it? There are the eyes. And then this is the spiritual eye. That's the star. I'm not going to deal that much with the seventh chakra, and I'll explain to you in a moment. And also, the medulla is also here. The medulla. The medulla and the spiritual eye are the two poles of the same chakra. Most people don't speak of the medulla, but Yogananda did. Most people just speak of the spiritual eye, but the medulla is a key. I'll explain that in a minute. Okay, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth chakra are what we'll mostly deal with here. Now, on the spectrum of complete egotism and Satchitanandam, let's say that the chakras represent that spectrum. And it's not simply that everything terrible goes into the first chakra, everything slightly less terrible goes into the second chakra. Because every chakra has a characteristic quality and the positive and negative aspect of that. So what we want to say is that on the spectrum of complete locked-in material egotism and Satchitanandam, every time you respond, it has a very specific cosmic vibration that corresponds to somewhere in the chakras, and that energy is stored. Energy is never lost, it just changes its form. You know, this is a huge scientific principle that there's just all the energy just keeps shifting. Okay, and so when you say, let's use as an example, the first chakra, which is a good one, has to do with security, and I'll explain this in a minute after the break better. Security. Now, our true source of security is our relationship to the infinite. We are one with the infinite spirit, which is ever conscious and ever blissful. So therefore, that's my source of security, isn't it? But gosh, it would certainly be nice to have a little money and maybe have a little house, you know. Little house would be nice, a little door in my little house. Maybe it would be nice to have some kids and a nice guy who takes care of me. You know, sure, God is my pure source of security, but these things are nice too, aren't they, right? So we're always acting just in the realm of security, somewhere between Satchitananda and perfect and simple materialism as the reality. We may love our husband and have a slight sense that he's also a manifestation of the divine. We may be really happy about our bank account and maybe also know that God is my provider. You know, it's not, nothing is clear cut. Nothing is ever black and white. It's always just a slightly shifting. And that the exact balance point, this is mathematics, this is metaphysics, the exact balance point of how much you are relying on the material, egoically based world and how much you're relying on the infinite spirit, every time you take a single action, even if you're putting your check in the bank, nobody does it anymore, but if you actually put your check in the bank, you know, and the degree to which you thank God for having enabled you to earn that money, or whether you just think, boy, I was really smart to negotiate this promotion, you know, that's a specific vibration and it registers somewhere in the chakras. The chakras are vortices of energy. Chakra means wheel. They're moving wheels of energy. And when you add to it, it gets bigger. When you have a realization that my happiness really never came from having that money anyway, you erase a little bit of it, and a little bit of this energy will move, let's say, up into this energy, the heart energy, or something like that. This is a constant interrelationship of these whirling fields of energy. And a whirlpool of energy always has a vortex, a center point. If you think of a river, and this is the best way to think of it, you think of a river and there's a whirlpool in a river, there's going to be a center point around which everything whirls. Isn't that so? And that center point might be, let's say, thinking of reincarnation, in my last lifetime, you know, there was a war and all the food supplies were taken and I starved to death. So the vortex becomes, so you die with the thought of, I do not ever want to be in the position where I'm depending on other people to bring me food. So the vortex is, I always have to have a really good food supply. So you're born with a very strong vortex of that. So you go out and you're born to a farm family. You study farming. You buy land, you learn organic gardening, you buy a hydrator, you have all your food. This vortex point there creates this huge field of energy all around it. And no matter how much food supply you have, you're always living with this slight fear that you're going to starve to death. Because when you starve to death, wherever you starve to death, you didn't just say gracefully and peacefully, Om Swaha, you know, this is Satchitananda, what difference does it make? We all have to die somehow. I'd rather be dying myself than have somebody else die of starvation. At least they're eating. You know, whatever you're thinking, you affirmed your own personal loss and you created a vortex around it. And that vortex registers. And this becomes your karma. Because when you physically die, your physical body falls away, but this energy pattern goes on. And when you're born in a physical body, this energy pattern, this is your blueprint. That's the body you make. That's why you're born in the country you're born in, to the people you're born to the privilege or lack of it, to the broken body. Because the energy pattern has accumulated, made a blueprint, and starts a new one. Yes?
It would be not like a specific karma. It would be little like crystals or griddles of many different things that create, you know, a karma that is bigger. It's like a accumulation.
Well, you're this and just to make it more interesting, this is all the lifetimes you've ever lived, because energy never goes away. So you have made this energy pattern of every thought, every feeling that you've ever had that makes these whirling vortices of energy registered in whatever is appropriate, and so you walk around. And you walk and step into the street and you get hit by a bus. And it wasn't even slightly random. There was all of these complicated energy patterns attracting each other, making it happen. Or you start to step in the street and somebody else says, no, don't step in front of the bus. You know, absolutely everything that happens to you, it's energy. This is an energy universe. There's nothing happening in this world but energy. The energy pattern in our chakras moves us through the world and attracts and repels and causes absolutely everything to happen. Now, the good news is, if you can affect that energy, you change everything. And energy can be affected by concentration, by meditation, by affirmation, by prayer, by grace. And you don't necessarily have to do all these things, live them out or act them out, but of course you have to put out commensurate energy. And then the third thing, which is great, is that Kriya Yoga, which is not the only technique, but any technique of meditation, and I'll show this to you more clearly in a moment, that runs energy up and down the spine through those chakras can dissolve these vortices without there being any apparent manifestation of it. You change it with pure energy. That's why people say, truly, don't worry about anything, just meditate.
So that's when you get balanced.
Meditation, ultimately, if you search to balance this, you eventually come to meditation. Because if you have to undo and redo every one of these vortices, you know, just to turn around on the freeway, I ran into construction and made a couple of other mistakes, and I created a whole other set of energy. If we decide, well, I was unkind then, so I'll be kind this time, and I took money then, so I'll give money this time. But if we just say, I'm just going to smooth out the whole energy pattern and gradually by my own inner realization become more and more conscious of Satchitananda, just as you have found in your life, I'm sure, that when you suddenly have a higher sense of awareness, you forgive things because you see them from another perspective. Right? And you never actually had to work it out. You just raised your level of perspective. A friend of mine who was abused as a child, she finally got to the point where she said, he must have had such a horrible life, that poor man, that he would have treated me that way. And that, you know, that when that thought crossed her mind, then her whole relationship to that experience shifted. Because she'd finally moved into a higher enough awareness that she could think compassionately about him instead of just self-concerned about her. It didn't change anything. It was still an awful thing for him to have done. It was still a terrible thing to have had happen. But she just raised her perspective on it. Oh, that poor little girl, which had been her, and oh, that poor man.
She also realized she was not that experience.
She separated herself. She separated herself from it, but she also raised her level to God's perspective, who God loved her and him, you see. But he, you know, he's really the one who's suffering more. Because she had the freedom to step outside of it, but he's the one who inflicted it. And she just had that awareness of, you know, what a nightmare the inside of his consciousness must be. And what suffering he's going to have to do. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. And then, of course, the thought may have crossed her mind, what did I do to have it come to me? Which is something that people don't like to think about, but nothing happens by accident. There has to be a lesson in it. Doesn't make it good. It doesn't excuse, but there has to be a lesson in it, you know, why you? You have to ask that question not, why me? But you have to ask that question of, why me? You know, what good thing was God giving me? What karmic balance was God giving me? Why would this happen to me? You see, it takes great maturity to really take this thing on. Because you see, then it's never anybody's fault. Nobody is ever wrong. Nobody actually ever does anything to you either. It's just that your magnetisms match, and you're there you are. It would never come into your aura if there wasn't a space in your aura for it to come in.
Is it a learning experience to awareness, towards consciousness?
Absolutely. Why don't we take a break? I need one if you don't.
Jesus says, never judge anyone.
Exactly. Here's my rule about breaks. If you need to go to the bathroom, if you need to get water, if you need to get tea, ask Nir Moha downstairs how to make tea. They just do whatever you need to do and come right back. Okay? Don't start a new world. Don't start conversations. Don't start shopping yet. Just pause.